Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. We are back with another one of our Run It Back series. Today we are going to be diving into the 2019 second round game between number one seed Duke and number nine seed UCF. Now, I know that we initially said that we weren't going to be doing two games from the same tournament, but the overwhelming majority of people seem to have wanted this game. It was requested at least five or six times in the reviews on the iTunes page, well, the Apple Podcast page for this podcast. And remember, if you want to request a game for us to do in one of these episodes, please leave us a five-star review. Say something nice about me. Say something okay about Reegs and tell us what game you want to hear. We do have a couple left in the stockpile that we are going to make sure that we do get to. But since so many people asked about this game, I felt like we needed to do it.
Give us random ones. I feel like we've gotten a lot of the traditional basic ones that everyone lists right away. I want a good random rewatch game. So I want to be shocked. Somebody shock me. That's my request in the comments.
Somebody shock you.
Somebody shock me with a game request.
All right. So that voice you just heard was Bobby Regan, the host of the Fundamentally Sound podcast. He is always my co-host here. And Reegs, before we actually get into this, it's a craft beer cast, man. So we got to talk a little bit about the beers that we're drinking. I'm going to let you go first because I have a take. I have a beer take that I need to get out. I've been kind of stewing on this for a while, and I need to get it out. So tell me what you're drinking.
So this is a random purchase. We were on our walk, my wife, kid, dog, and I, around the neighborhood, brewery right in the neighborhood. They released three brand new beers. One of the ones was just it's a High Grain Brewery. It's the name of the brewery. It's a carbon neutral IPA. It's just a regular IPA, 6%, nothing fancy to it. Just basic, really good. They're known for that kind of stuff. They also picked on a 4-pack up for my wife who really likes it. It's a strawberry lime sour, strawberry lime sour, which I know is not your cup of tea, but check out High Grain. The poor guy almost had his hand eaten off by my dog because they tried to give him a little treat, and I have a 95-pound chocolate lab that was excited.
That'll happen, man.
Yeah.
That'll happen. Can't trust your wife, though. One, she married you. Two, she likes raspberry lime sours. Can't trust her.
I will say, it was a refreshing drink.
Of course you liked it.
It was refreshing.
So I am actually drinking a Heady Topper. And for those of you that don't know Heady Topper, it is one of the IPAs that beer snobs and hopheads like Reegs and like myself. It's just one of the ones that everybody tries to find because it's very difficult to get, and it's delicious. Like, don't get me wrong. I love it. It's one of my favorite beers, but here's my hot take, Reegs. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I don't think that Heady Topper is good enough that it deserves the hype that it gets. And what I mean by that is that, look, it's a really, really good beer. And when I saw it at my local, I actually got this from the Wegmans by me. And there were four singles in the refrigerator, and I grabbed all four of them. And I know that the guy behind me was kind of eyeing them because he gave me a little bit of a dirty look when I grabbed all four of them. But you know what? I don't care. It's a Coronation. I got to get my IPAs when I can get them. But my take is that beers like Heady Topper and beers like Pliny the Elder and things like Lunch kind of get this name brand associated with them, where you get this idea that it's going to be a life-changing experience the first time that you actually get to try it. And it's really not. Like, look, Heady Topper is delicious. It's one of my five favorite IPAs. Anytime that I see it, I'm going to get it and I'm going to drink it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it justifies like waiting in line to get it, or seeing like buying out the grocery store every time that I see it in the store. Like, it's not that much better than some of the other stuff that I can get locally that doesn't have anywhere near the kind of the name brand recognition. And it got me to thinking, like, it's kind of that way with like Pappy Van Winkle with whiskey too. And like, there are certain wines that I've had that are super expensive and super rare and super hard to get, but it's, when you drink them, it's not fundamentally all that much different than drinking. Like so how about this? My wife's company 1 year they bought out a really high-end new restaurant in DC about 6 years ago. And when you buy out the restaurant, you just basically pay like a flat rate, and then everything is on the house until you hit that rate, and then it becomes open bar after that. We were like probably 10K short of that number because they expected us to drink a lot more than we did. And a guy that I worked with for 6 years at my bar was actually our server. And he was like, look, you guys are never going to come anywhere near what the minimum is for buying out this restaurant. So I'm going to go open up that $1,000 bottle of wine and give it to you. And I drank it, and don't get me wrong, it was great. It paired perfectly with the duck that we were eating there, but it wasn't like the kind of thing where I was like, yes, I would definitely pay $1,000 for this again. And I feel the same way with Hattie Topper. I kind of feel the same way with Pliny. I feel the same way when it comes to Pappy. Now, when you go out and get like a really, really good steak, like, you can taste the difference between like a filet and just getting like a chuck roast or something like that, right? Like, you can taste the difference when you go out and like you buy like the some good chicken and cook it well, or you buy like the stuff that is like 99 cents a pound and you're getting it because it's almost expired. Like, you, when it comes to food, there's certain things where it's actually like worth the money to pay up a little bit. Whereas I'm not quite sure that Hattie Topper is worth, as much as I like it, I don't know if it's worth the money that you pay for and the brand that's associated with it. And I don't know. I just felt like I kind of had to get that out a little bit.
All right, Fancy Pants. I agree that Hattie Topper isn't worth all that, because to me, no beer is. With how many different breweries and how many different beers are available today, just it ain't worth it. I disagree about your Pappy take, because A, it's just so limited. Like, there is a limited selection of great bourbon, whereas like the selection for beer is just, there is no exceptional beer, right? Or there are plenty exceptional beers, is I guess how I should phrase it. Actually, yes. You know what? It's like this year in college basketball. There are plenty of fine teams. Plenty of teams could win a championship. Many beers could do the job. There ain't a great one. Pappy, they are 2018 Nova, 2015 Kentucky, or 2012 Kentucky. They're that once in a decade few teams that you're debating greatest of all time. Like, that's how it is with bourbon. There's just so many, there's limited competition for Pappy, where I think there is such a jump that it's worth waiting for and everything like that.
It's also probably a bad comparison, because like, to get one, when it comes to making bourbon, like, don't you have to age it for like 12 years to get it to be as good as it is?
It depends on what it is. So it's like, bourbon is a certain, like, that's how it's part of what differentiates like bourbon to whiskey to all that other stuff, is like how long it's aged and whatnot. But yeah, so to have a good bourbon, like, that's one of the things I've definitely, as I've gotten older and snobbier, I've gotten to the point where it's like, I don't want to drink. I mean, I will, but like, if I'm going to sit on my chair and sip a glass of bourbon, I'm going out and buying like, you know, the $70 bottle that I can enjoy versus choking down like the $10 bottle that I'm throwing in a mixed drink.
Yeah, that's probably a fair take. Like, I would say that I would rate Pappy compared to the field of bourbon, and Hattie Topper compared to like the field of IPAs is kind of similar. But when it comes to Pappy, like, there isn't really anything else at that level. And I think it goes the same way with wine too.
Yeah. Like wine's I think in the middle ground, where there's a little bit more competition of like the super nice wine versus, it's not as exclusive as Pappy, but it's not as prevalent as like Hattie Topper.
Yeah. And with bourbon, like with wine, it's part of the thing is like the age of it and how old it is. That's kind of what adds to the exclusivity of it. That was a hard word to say.
It was.
Like with Hattie Topper or with Pliny, like, if they run out, they can just kind of go make a new batch. Right, right. You know, it's not like
it doesn't take that long.
It doesn't take like decades to be able to make it as good as it is. So that's probably why there's a little bit less of a market for the beer. I don't know. It's just something I was chewing on since I got the Heady, and it's something that I had to kind of talk through a little bit. All right. So let's talk about this, this Duke UCF 2019 game. And honestly, like, I remember heading into this game and feeling like UCF had a very legitimate chance to keep this thing close. I went heavy on, I think the line closed at Duke minus 17. Yeah. Or maybe it opened at Duke minus 6. It went from 17 to 13 one way. I can't remember which way that it went. But all I know is that I was heavy on UCF. And part of the reason why I said that is because I really just felt like this was the perfect matchup for Duke. Like, this was kind of like the nut matchup when it comes to them getting picked off by somebody a little bit early. So why don't you just kind of walk us through a little bit, like, we don't really need to remember what the Duke season was last year, but kind of just like set the stage for that team, how we got to this point, Zion Williamson, blah, 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 everything that kind of went into it.
Yeah. So obviously they opened the season just kicking Kentucky's ass in the Champions Classic. And that kind of set the stage for the rest of the season, right? Like, that was the casual fans' welcome party to Zion and that freshman group, which was RJ Barrett, Cam Reddish, and
Trey Jones.
I always want to call him Tyus. Trey Jones. And so that kind of, Zion had that ridiculous game against Kentucky. They lose their first game, which was honestly a way better game than this UCF game, was the Maui Invitational Final against Gonzaga by two. And that, what's funny about that is that kind of set the tone for, is Krzyzewski going to screw this up in a way where, if you remember correctly, that Gonzaga game, they went a lot of RJ Barrett ISO late in that game and kind of took the ball out of Zion's hands. And I don't necessarily disagree that it made sense to give the ball to RJ Barrett. Like, he's a playmaker, right? Like, I understood that. But it also felt like Krzyzewski, in a way, was just deferring to that verse. Wait a minute. We have the better option right here, too. And I don't want to disparage Barrett's, like, passing ability, because I do think he was a little undervalued. Like, we'll get into Barrett, I'm sure, later. But his reputation, I think, was a little incorrect of who he actually was as a player at Duke last season. But that kind of set – those two games set the tone in the non-conference. They lose to Syracuse because they always lose to Syracuse at least once. Zion blew a shoe out. Don't know if you heard about that. That happened. There was a lot of talk about it.
The Zion Williamson shoe thing seriously made me consider, like, whether or not I'm in the right field. Just because the way that thing blew up and how much we had to – can talk about it. Oh man, it drove me insane.
One of my most read blogs was the day after I blogged that. Do you remember Obama was there and he wore that fire bomber jacket with the little personalized 44 yes. on it? That was like one of the most read blogs. It just had Obama and Zion in it. And it's like, what are we doing with our lives? Yeah. So they actually kind of, you know, Zion's hurt with the shoot. You know, we blew the shoe out, he got hurt. So they lose, what, 3 of 6 down the stretch? Carolina twice and Virginia Tech. Then they win the ACC tournament.
With Zion back.
And I'll tell you what, like, they kind of like righted the wrongs in a way during the ACC tournament, right? Like, they beat Syracuse, a team they lost to, beat Carolina in the semis, a team that they were swept by. And then they beat Florida State in the title game, which I think that I wonder how many people would get right if that was the ACC title game. I think everyone just assumes Virginia was there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so they enter the tournament as a one seed, the number one overall seed, right? They're the number one overall seed.
Number one overall.
Beat North Dakota State, and then that sets us up with the UCF game.
Yeah, and kind of the undercurrent of this entire Duke season and this entire Duke tournament was that this was, I think you can make the argument, the most talented team that Coach K has had at Duke, at least in like this era, right?
Yeah,
it's probably not more talented than like the 2000 and was 2001 when they had like Shane Battier.
Oh yeah, no, but I was saying I might even lean the 2015 team a little bit. It's close. Like, you could have the debate. It's like, you know, it's like when
yeah, I guess, but like 2015, you had a bunch of guys that are just kind of regular Joes in the NBA, whereas like 2019, like, you have Zion, and then you had Cam Reddish, and you had you had so much talent on that team.
Oh, sure, sure.
That Cam Reddish, like, was completely pushed into a role where he was almost kind of rendered pretty ineffective. Like, that to me, that was the most interesting part about this entire season, is that you had all of these pieces and all of this talent, and you can never outside of that first game, you can never quite get them playing up to the level that maybe we should have expected, right? Like, there was always this kind of idea that the pieces just didn't fit perfectly. Like, there wasn't enough shooting to be able to space the floor and create room for Zion Williamson or RJ Barrett to work around the bucket, because that's where they work at their best, right? There wasn't enough.
Go ahead. I have a take as to why the pieces didn't fit.
Why is that?
The pieces weren't that good outside of the core four, the four freshmen.
Well, yeah.
Like, that's definitely true, but like, good.
part of the problem was,
and we'll get into that during this game, because it plays a part in it. But like, Marcus Bolden was not that, like,
well, I'm not. First of all,
player Jack White, like, just list.
It's Marquise Bolden.
Whatever, Marquise.
If you say Marcus again, then I'm probably not going to do anything. But it's Marquise Bolden.
I'm going to call Marcus again.
It's one of the things that I have listed as I hated for this game, is that his name is Marquise. Like, I can never actually get that right.
So yeah, Bolden, like, Alex O'Connell, Jack White, Jevon Delorier, Jordan Goldwire, like, they just weren't that good of players.
Yeah, but they had guys that, in theory, should be able to fill the role that they're supposed to be able to play. Like Jack White, in theory, is a 6'7" guy that can guard a little bit on the perimeter, that can protect the rim a little bit, and that, like, at one point in time this season was shooting 43% from three.
Right.
After the Texas Tech game. Like, he was – there was a while where he was, like, that kind of perfect versatile piece that could guard bigs if you needed to. It can make him completely switchable 1-5, and he was also able to space the floor, so you didn't have to play Jevon Delorier, you didn't have to play Marquise Bolden. You could play Jack White at the five, and you don't have to rely on strictly Zion Williamson being just the only big guy you have on the floor.
Right,
but Jack White, he missed 28 straight threes at one point this season. He was 0-10 against Syracuse. It was horrible. Like, I couldn't even, like, it felt bad watching him.
Yeah. But why I said, like, I think why I would lean the 2015 team, and maybe I phrased it wrong in terms of, like, the most talented, of why I think 2015 was the better team. They actually had, like, balance across their depth, right? Like,
they were definitely
on the bench. Quinn Cook was the fourth, it was there. Matt Jones filled his role. And then you obviously had Okafor, Winslow, Emile Jefferson. Like, they just fit better. Like, and they had better, I guess, 1-8. Was better, but for this 2019 team, 1, 2, and 3 were probably 1, 2, and 3 if you're drafting this team, or drafting between, maybe, you know, probably in there.
The point you're making that they were a better team is, like, inarguable, because,
it came up during the broadcast, which is why I wanted to bring it up.
Yeah. The other problem was Cam Reddish. So when all of this stuff happened, like, correct me if I'm wrong, Cam Reddish was the first guy that committed to Duke, right? Of those, the big three. You went Cam Reddish first, and then RJ Barrett committed. And then, really unexpectedly, which is something that's kind of in the news now, but kind of out of nowhere, Zion Williamson committed to Duke, because everyone, the way that it went with Zion's recruitment is, like, everyone kind of thought that he was going to end up going to Kansas. He was an Adidas guy. He played for an Adidas AAU program that was sponsored and run by his stepfather. And, like, it was just kind of accepted, he's probably going to end up going to Kansas, because that's just what happens when you are, like, a big Kansas.
It's the Kansas. Kansas is the blue blood for Adidas programs.
Yeah. And, so, and just in, like, general. Or like Indiana and Romeo Langford, whatever it is. Right. So it was kind of accepted that he was going to end up going there, until all of this FBI stuff came out. And, like, they weren't sure exactly who was on tape saying what and who got caught doing what. Like, I don't know if you remember this, but in the months after that happened, like, all the conversations that I was having with people were like, how come Kansas isn't involved in this? What's going on with Kansas? Moral Code was, like, in there with Zion Williamson. Like, that was the connected Adidas, blah, 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 all this other kind of stuff. And the biggest talking point in the first couple of weeks and months after those initial FBI things were released was, like, why isn't Kansas involved with this? So once that kind of came out, that shut down the whole Adidas Kansas angle. So all of a sudden, Zion realized like he probably needed to go to a Nike school, and everyone thought it was going to be hometown Clemson. And then it was like a Saturday afternoon. I can't remember what happened that day, but I remember like the biggest news, like kind of out of nowhere, was Zion Williamson committed to Duke. And that changed the entire dynamic of that roster, because now you have Zion, RJ, and Cam are all kind of similar in that they are like
January. So it would have been during a college basketball.
Yeah, it was during the college basketball season. I just remember it was like a really good day of games, but then like out of nowhere, Zion Williamson committed, and it was like, drop everything. Zion Williamson's going to Duke. And remember, like for people that don't realize this, but Zion Williamson at the time was not considered to be the best player in the class. Like this was RJ Barrett's team. The 2020 draft was the draft. Well, no, 2019 draft was the draft to get RJ Barrett. Like in October, everyone thought he was the best player in the draft.
All right. Trivia question. Can you name, there were plenty of good games that day. I have the schedule up from the day that Zion committed. Can you guess one matchup?
One matchup.
It was obviously during conference play.
Oh man, there was. Didn't Duke lose? No, Duke won. I don't remember. Yeah, what was the big game of the day?
So the day started. According to KenPom, the best day or the best game was Xavier Seton Hall, where JP McCura had that ridiculous putback dunk that went viral.
Oh yeah.
You had Florida beating Kentucky. You had Houston, Wichita State, Kansas State, TCU is technically the second best game of the day in 2018.
I don't remember any of those games.
I distinctly remember the Xavier Seton Hall game. But that was, and then it ended with Oregon, UCLA in the 90s.
Yeah, because that was like the Lonzo Ball, that team, right? Yeah, but so. The thing about Zion going to Duke was that him, RJ, and Cam all kind of were the same player, like ball dominant wings that were going to Duke to kind of play like the Jason Tatum role or the Jabari Parker wing. Yeah. And RJ was better than Cam, obviously. And I have a nice little trivia question about him. And Zion Williamson is are obviously better than Cam. So Cam was kind of forced to play this role of being like the spot up shooter. Floor spacer, when like that's not really what he does. Like he's a guy that can make shots as opposed to being a guy that is a shooter. And like when he was growing up and he was playing at West Town, when he was playing on the AAU circuit, like he was a guy that was like a ball handler. Like I don't want to say he was a point guard, but he kind of played the same role that RJ Barrett played, and like he was the lead guard for his team. So it created a logjam at the same spot, and like that to me is why it didn't necessarily fit. If let's say Cam Reddish was built more in the mold of someone like a Cam Johnson, where he was just a pure off the ball player and a shooter. They're like the same guys, or the same size, same first name, kind of play the same position, played in the same state in the same conference. Just one of them was like nothing but a shooter, and the other guy was a little bit more of like a ball handler, a guy that needs the ball in his hands to be effective. If Cam Reddish played like Cam Johnson, then I think Duke wins a national title because you have less of the issues about floor spacing, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. And I just think that it works out a little bit better. So that, to me, the larger point that I was making is that the underlying story and all of this stuff heading into the season for him was like, okay, is Coach K, he has all this talent, the best player he's ever going to coach at Duke. Is he gonna lose in the tournament again early? Like, is he gonna be able to actually get to the Final Four with this one? Because you look at some of those best teams he had outside of 2015 when they won the title. Like Jabari Parker lost in the first round of the tournament. Austin Rivers lost early in the NCAA tournament. Austin Rivers was on the team that lost to Lehigh, right? Am I remembering that right?
Yes.
Whatever it was, 2012 they lost early in the NCAA tournament. 2017,
yeah, that was Austin Rivers and Seth Curry in the backcourt. Like,
yes,
just
yes.
Ridiculous. Like, looking at where they are now, how does that team lose to CJ?
Well, I mean, CJ McCollum ended up being the best NBA player out of them. So, and then 2017, when they had Jason Tatum and Grayson Allen and Harry Giles and that entire team, they ended up losing in the second round to South Carolina playing a road game.
It was still an hour away from home.
Yeah, whatever. 2018, they lost. They didn't make it to the Final Four. So it's just kind of like this narrative that's built up somewhat unfairly, but it's something that, like, again, we talked about how people love to hate on Duke. Like, it's kind of built up to the point where, like, Coach K can't get it done. And, you know, Cal dealt with this a little bit early on in his tenure when
still dealing with it, I think.
Yeah, still dealing with it. But it's different now because he's not getting this, like, he's not getting the, like, four of the top 10 recruits anymore. Now he's getting like four of the top 25. And
right,
it's a little bit different level of expectation when you don't get, like, when you have John Wall, DeMarcus Cousins, Eric Bledsoe, like, it's one thing. When you have, like, when your best recruit is like Keldon Johnson, it's a entirely different conversation. You know what I'm saying? And so, like, Duke is at the point now where they are getting John Wall, DeMarcus Cousins, and Eric Bledsoe, and they are not winning at the level that you would expect of a team that has like top five picks all up and down your roster. So
honestly,
I guess
that the 2015 team really bailed Krzyzewski and like of Duke out, because if they lose that game or don't win that tournament, you know, they have the one in 2010, but that was kind of a weird tournament to begin with, right? Where you have Butler, like, you know, you had the Kentucky team, but which I think was could be considered a great team, but that was a wide open tournament. At least that's how it was perceived. You have that, you know, a missed half court shot. Outside of that, like, if they don't win in 2015, you don't have another Final Four trip under your belt, unless he obviously makes the Final Four and loses in 2015. You're going a long way back for Krzyzewski here. And I think, you know, I'm not saying that his job would be in jeopardy, but I think the view of what he was doing shifts more to how people kind of view Calipari from a, you know, from the 1,000-foot angle or however you look at it.
Yeah, it definitely helped change a little bit of the narrative. And, like, it's very easy to say this in hindsight, like, oh yeah, if you take away this national title, well, you know what? He won a national title. It's not like that. It's very hard to, like, take that away. But yet your point is 100% correct. Like, they haven't won an ACC regular season title since what, 2007 or so? Something like that.
Crazy.
Anyway, heading into this game, the most interesting matchup was obviously going to be, like, the ability of Duke to get to the rim, like RJ Barrett and Zion Williamson get into the bucket, and the fact that UCF had the single greatest rim protection device in the history of college basketball in 7'5" Taco Fall. And I love Taco Fall. I have a bunch of nuggets about him. I have a bunch of anecdotes about stuff that he did. Like, I did a big story on him his sophomore season. They played a game at GW, and I said this last week on the podcast. My point guard from college is now the UCF SID. So I went to the GW game, and I was able to get like 25, 30 minutes with Taco Fall after the game, just talking to him. Like, he's like just a legitimately great kid.
Yeah.
And, go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't want to say I don't like Taco Fall. I've had enough of Taco Fall.
Well, here's what I was going to get to, is that he's one of, like, the friendliest, the sweetest, like, really, really, really smart. But he's kind of turned into a little bit of what, like, kind of like, remember what Brian Scalabrine was in Boston, where he was the white mamba? He's
Boban without Boban's personality and, like, being funny.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. He's turned into, in the words of Dan Forcella, I had a conversation with him about this. Like, we were talking once about how you always see the pictures, every broadcast, every game that UCF gets played in, like, you see a picture of, like, the sideline reporter or the play-by-play guy taking a picture with Taco Fall to show how tall he is, or they put something on the broadcast about him grabbing the rim and pulling it down without jumping. And I remember, like, someone once asked Dan, like, he's the UCF SID, he's like, why don't you have a picture like that with Taco? He's like, Taco's my friend, and I'm not going to treat him like a freak. And it's kind of gotten to the point where he's like something of a sideshow, right? And, like, I think that he's kind of gotten to the point where he's embraced it a little bit. Like, you ask him about it, you see quotes about it where he basically says, I understand people, I'm unique. I'm one of the 40 tallest people in the world. People haven't seen somebody as tall as me before. Like, they're going to want to take a picture with that. And like, he understands it, but he said also, like, eventually I want people to say that because they know me as a basketball player, not just because they know me as that tall guy that they happen to see in the airport. Right. So I think that his mentality is wrapped around it, but it does kind of, I don't know. I've never, what Dan said always kind of has stuck with me, and it's always been something that has been in my head, but his, I don't know if you remember this, Reese, but his like journey to get there was just wild.
I do.
Like, he came from, so he's from Senegal.
Yep.
And when he first got to the States, he was supposed to go to the same high school that like Ben McLemore went to and a bunch of other guys went to. But once he got to the States, they were like, no, we don't have space. So he went to some like random school in Houston that lost its accreditation with the high school association in Texas after like one semester that he was there. So then he was bouncing around from like Tennessee to Georgia to all these other places trying to find a school that would accept his I-20 visa. And he finally ended up after like, I think it was probably a full year that he was going to different like public schools and different private schools, trying to find a place that would accept his visa that he could actually get into school. He ended up at a place called Liberty Christian in Orlando. And they accepted it. Like he all A's and B's. He had a 3.6 GPA. Like he was a really smart kid, really great student. But the problem that they ran into is that Liberty Christian is not a school that is known for being a Division I powerhouse. So like they had problems with the NCAA while he's getting like, he has like a 4.0 GPA, getting A's and B's as an engineering major at UCF. And they're like, yeah, we don't know if we can accept your initial eligibility requirements, when it's just kind of like, look at this fucking GPA right now.
Plus he had he's the single killing- greatest high school highlight of all time. Like,
yes,
take Seventh Woods out of it. Take Zion Williams, all those famous mixtapes, take it out. And just the short, hefty fella who definitely played offensive line, just bodying him up, looking confused. Everybody knows the GIF. Everybody knows the video.
Oh, it's so funny.
It's the greatest high school highlight of all time.
Yeah. So we like at first when he gets to UCF, like he's not initially eligible. He's got to sit out of practices, and eventually he gets cleared and it all gets settled after a couple games. So it was, I remember I wrote a couple columns about it, just being like, you need, if the NCAA can't get Tackle Fall right, they need to get out of the initial eligibility business. Cause we're talking about a kid that's a legitimate student that should be your poster boy. He's come all the way from Senegal. He's got himself a scholarship. Like he had never played basketball when he got here. He got himself a scholarship. Like, He was sending his stipend checks. You know how you get the cost of attendance stipend now? He was sending those checks back home to his family in Senegal so his mom could pay for his little brother, right, to go to a school where he could actually get educated. And it's like, that's the kid getting a 3.8 in engineering at UCF. Like, you're not going to let him be eligible. It was a big thing, but Tackle Fall eventually made it. Obviously he was awesome in this game. And we're going to dive into this game, but as always, we're going to do a trivia before we actually get to the game, because trivia is my favorite part, low-key. So are you ready, Riggs?
Let's go.
We're going to start with this. Entering the NCAA tournament, how many three-pointers did Jordan Goldwire make on the entire season?
Entering would be one.
And how many did he make in the NCAA tournament combined?
Like going into this game or?
In total, the entire NCAA tournament. You were about to say it.
Well, he made two, I know, going during
this game. It was two. He finished the season 3 for 25 from three. He was 2 for 21 entering the UCF game.
I thought he made two in the first round and then made another two.
Yeah. So we will get deep into this when it happens. But in the second half, when UCF just stops guarding Trey Jones and Jordan Goldwire on the perimeter, there's an amazing moment at the 11:46 mark of the second half where Terrell Allen is supposed to be guarding Jordan Goldwire from beyond the arc. And he just walks away and you can see him going like this, waving his hand at him. Shoot it. Go ahead. Shoot it. That's the shot we want. Shoot it. Daring him to shoot while standing 10 feet off of him is the most disrespectful thing I've ever seen on a basketball court. You're a point guard for Duke, and you have this guy, Terrell Allen, saying, go ahead, shoot it. That's the shot we want. That's the kind of thing that you do when you're playing in like a men's league or at the park, and it's like this guy that you know you could get in his head.
I even get in high school, where you just have like the point guard that can't shoot, and but he's like, you have him out there, like he's fine.
Yeah,
that's the guy where you're like, all right, we're putting our two guard who refuses to defend anybody is just going to stand out there and just do that nonstop.
Yeah. Go ahead. Shoot it. Oh, yep. That was so funny. I was cracking up. I forgot about that until I went back and rewatched it. And I saw it again. And I was like, oh, that's great. I love Terrell Allen. I'm always going to be a fan just because of that. All right. Yeah. So, how many straight jump balls did Tackle Fall win to close out his collegiate career?
33. Cause he had 32 and he won this one.
Yep.
It's the first note I took.
Yeah. All right. Good. Because I heard that and I was like, Reed's probably going to know this, but it's still just amazing. 33 straight jump ball.
The fact that he just was able to time all of them even.
Yeah. All right. RJ Barrett averaged 22 points. It was more than this, but he averaged 22 something points, 7 something rebounds, and 4 something assists. Only one other player in the high major ranks since 1992, which is as far back as Basketball References database goes, crossed all three thresholds in the same season. 22 points, 7 boards, and 4 assists. Do you know who that is?
God, I remember hearing it all.
I've made this point a lot, so you've probably heard me say it before.
It's not Carmelo, right?
Not Carmelo.
Is it Durant? No. Not Durant. Beasley.
Not Beasley.
Ooh.
You got to go further back.
Further back, okay. But so it's 02 to...
402. 92 is how far back.
Oh, 92. Oh, for some reason I thought 02.
You got to go back to 92. He's from the South. He's from the City of Blues. He played for Memphis State.
Penny.
As a redshirt sophomore playing in the Great Midwest Athletic Conference, I think that's what it was, right? The Great Midwest Conference?
Something like that.
But that, whatever the name of that league was, he was playing in that league. He averaged 22-7-4. And he was the only other guy to do that since 92 was RJ Barrett. And he did it as a freshman playing in the ACC.
Yeah,
so when like with this idea that like RJ Barrett wasn't good or had a disappointing freshman year, like RJ was fucking unbelievable that season. 22-7-4.
I know.
On the same team as Zion, like it's just right.
There
were a lot of things that Coach K got wrong during this season, but like RJ Barrett was not specifically the problem, and I will go to my grave saying that. All right, so the game itself, it kind of goes back and forth for probably the first 17 to 18 minutes of the first half, right? Like the only really notable thing that happens during that stretch is Taco Fall picks up 2 fouls, which is something that we're going to have to get into.
And Cam Reddish.
Yeah, but I mean, Cam Reddish, whatever.
But I'm saying like going back to earlier where we said they only have like 4
true,
good
true,
players.
True, you're right. So Cam Reddish does pick up 2 fouls in the first half as well. He's just in foul trouble the entire game as a result. And then at the end of the first half, Duke goes on this little run, takes a 41-34 lead into the break. They're up by 7. UCF makes a run at the start of the second half. They tie it, and then there's 2 more times throughout the second half where Duke ends up pushing the lead to 7 points. The last one, they get it to 66-59. UCF makes their little run. They end up taking the lead. They're up 74-70, and that is when, like, the Aubrey Dawkins missed alley-oop comes into play. That is when Cam Reddish answers with the 3. We're going to get into all of that. And then obviously there is like the way that the game ends, it's 76-73. Zion gets an and one, misses the free throw. RJ Barrett gets the putback offensive rebound. So Duke takes the lead at the other end of the floor. Johnny Dawkins calls a play to get BJ Taylor the ball going downhill. He misses the runner and Aubrey Dawkins has the tip in that bounces off the backboard and then rolls just barely off the rim the same way that Grayson Allen's shot rolled off the rim against Kansas in the 2018 Elite Eight. So Duke ends up winning. They survive. They get through. Zion Williamson had 32 points and 13 boards. Taco Fall was really, really good. Aubrey Dawkins finished with 32 points. Like a lot of great stuff in this game. But I think the first thing that I want to get to, where do you want to start? What do you want to start with this?
Can I start with the take that I wanted to start the show with?
Yeah, go ahead.
The game kind of sucked. It was just an awesome ending. Like, it was not a well-played game. Aubrey Dawkins had a great game. Taco played fine, but he was in foul. It was a very choppy game. Like, there were a lot of fouls. It was sloppy early. Like, there were a handful of turnovers. The game was decided, ultimately, on a missed dunk. Like,
yeah.
The game itself was not great. The outcome was great, if that makes sense.
So
that's my hot take about the game.
This is where I'm going to disagree with you, because I think what made this game great was the little things that happened in the coaching matchup and the coaching battle.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I'm just saying, like, in terms of when I think great games, I think of the games that we like the Duke UConn 99 game,
Kansas State Xavier, like those, unbelievable shot.
The games right? where it, I felt not as much, you know, I lean a little bit more this way where I felt like UCF kind of lost the game because of a certain play. But like we said with Kansas State Xavier and Kentucky Wichita State and UConn Duke, it didn't feel like either team lost that game. It was like UConn won it, Kentucky won it, Kansas State won it.
Somebody had to win the game, and this right. is the team that did.
Right. So that's my hot take about the game. And don't get me wrong, like I enjoyed rewatching it, but I kind of forgot how sloppy it was and how choppy it was.
Yeah, it was pretty sloppy, but I expected that. And the reason I expected that is because UCF was one of the best defensive teams in the country yeah. heading into this game. And the way that it kind of built their defense, specifically for this game where it was kind of like exaggerated, was they dare teams to shoot. And what they did is they said, the only way that you're going to beat us is by getting to the rim. So they would force teams to drive. Well, they dared Duke to shoot, but they overall, right. they would force teams to drive, and they would kind of funnel people into Taco Fall, who is like a 7'6", yep. just a monster. And by the way, another funny anecdote about Taco Fall, I had forgotten about this, is that he did not there was a little bit of tension, and obviously it was all joking, but there was a little bit of tension between him and like kind of the sports information department, because he was the only guy on the roster that didn't get the bump for like, you know how if like you're 6'2", then you could be 6'3" or whatever. So he's like when you measure him, he's like 7'5" and change, and you can round it up to 7'6". But most guys, when that happens, they'll give you like 7'7" because you're 7'7" with shoes. And the UCF athletic department like wouldn't do that, because he's legitimately like whatever the ranking is in terms of like the tallest people on the planet.
It matters.
Like he's at the top, where like if you gave him that extra inch, right. then it would change being what his 6'4". Ranking is. So they like if you're 6'4" and inflated to 6'5", whatever. If you're 7'6" and inflated to 7'7", like there's some ranking where that actually matters. So yeah. he was always like, "You'll never give me 7'7". And they're like, "We can't, because you're like you matter internationally.
Yeah,
but that extra inch matters."
The only other time you can't do that is if you're 5'11" and say you're 6 foot. That's the only that's the only other ranking that matters.
That's very true. But I thought it was hilarious that every guy on the plane understands that this issue where it's like you want to be just that 1 inch taller. And then you have Taco Fall, who's 7'6", and he's all pissed because he can't get 7'7". Taco so much, man.
My senior year in high school, they wouldn't let any of us list as 6 foot because nobody was 6 foot. Our tallest guy is 5'11". And our assistant coach who played college ball, he's like, "No," he's like, "if we're going to be good this year," he's like, "I want everyone to know we have nobody that's 6 foot on this roster." So our entire like guideline was just 5'11", 5'11", 5'9", 5'9", 5'9", 5'11".
That's awesome. I love it. All right. So I forgot. What were we talking about again? The defense. So
that's what I wanted to start with. But let's start with – I mean, we got to start with Aubrey Dawkins, right? Like he was the star of the game until the last, minute and 10 seconds.
Even in the last minute and 10 seconds, like even with that, I consider him the star of the game. He was the shots that he made.
But I should say he was the story of the game until the last minute and 10 seconds.
Even the story, man, like he was just so damn good. I get what you're saying. I mean, Aubrey Dawkins, some of the shots that he hit.
Oh.
And that was a whole nother part of the narrative that just kind of got buried in this, is that when Aubrey Dawkins was growing up, like his dad was an assistant coach at Duke.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure, like, didn't he live in Durham for a while?
No, Chapel Hill.
No, I'm saying
until he's 10.
Yeah, so his dad.
They talked about it nonstop.
Yeah, they talked about it nonstop. So, like, obviously, his Johnny Dawkins, the head coach at UCF, for people that don't know, played for Coach K. Like, he was part of that 86 team. Yeah, I know, baffling, right? Breaking news.
Coach K didn't even mention that during one of his 3 interviews.
Oh, yeah, that was really funny. His interview, yeah, he did. He said to Tracy Wolfson, Aubrey Dawkins must have gotten some extra reps in when he was living in Durham.
Yeah,
like he was great. I mentioned the coaching battle before, right? Like some of the coaching tweets. And so specifically what I thought was fascinating was Duke made their little run at the end of the first half by throwing on the press, right? And every time it felt like they would go on this little surge. Like they would throw on your favorite, the 2-2-1 press.
I know.
And it would be Jordan Goldwire and Trey Jones at the top, Zion Williamson and RJ, or Zion Williamson and Cam Reddish kind of in that second level, and then whoever the big guy on the floor was as a back.
Sometimes they'd have Zion in the back.
Yeah, sometimes. Like, low-key, though, Duke's best lineups, and I think the best lineups that Zion's going to play in the NBA is when he plays as the small ball five.
100%.
Like the Draymond Green five role.
100%.
He's uniquely suited to playing that role. So that's how UCF got a little bit of separation at the end of the first half. But where UCF's response, I thought, was just absolutely brilliant, was that they just stopped. They put Taco Fall on Trey Jones or Jordan Goldwire starting at the 15-minute mark, and they just did not guard those two. And they did end up hitting, I think Trey hit a three and another jumper, and Jordan Goldwire also hit a three. But for the most part, like they just dared those guys to shoot, and they were like 3-for-12 shooting the jumpers. Where what UCF did was throw a big body on Zion, force him to drive straight into Taco, and Taco like held his own. Man, he picked up a couple fouls. He probably should have gotten called for like 1, 2, 7, or 8 more, yeah. Maybe. But for the most part, like, he just did his job and just kind of protected the rim. And I thought that was fascinating, because once you stop Duke from scoring, you stop them from getting in their press. Once you stop them from getting in their press, then all of a sudden, like, their means of creating tempo, because that was the whole thing with this team, was transition, right?
Yeah.
And once you stop that, then it changed everything for him. So I thought that battle between the tactical battle between Johnny Dawkins and Coach K was fascinating right there.
It was, because obviously Dawkins knows Duke's system, playing there and just being around Krzyzewski and everything. So, you know, yeah, like, coaches adapt to the times, but Krzyzewski's system is pretty much the same as it's been since he started. So that's where it's interesting when you have somebody like Dawkins who knows that so well, and then you throw the wrinkles of having a guy like Taco Fall while also having guys like Trey Jones, Jordan Goldwire, you know, that the non-offensive shooting threats at the time, where the Johnny Dawkins wrinkles are way more fascinating to me, because it becomes, okay, is he going to overthink that? Like, going into the game, is he going to overthink this? Where, I know Duke so well, I'm going to do this. And then, you know, what's the saying? The master becomes, or the master shows the student, or whatever, the master becomes the teacher, where
the student becomes the teacher,
but the reverse of that, where he what I'm saying, like, instead of the student becomes the teacher just has the extra wrinkle at the end, like the veteran move, where there's some sort of saying, whatever.
You're making up sayings now, but I get your point.
Day 72 of quarantine, whatever. But that was, I remember watching that, sitting there going that, like, how is this going to be played? Is he going to overthink it? Whatever. So it was interesting to see that for sure. But I don't know. Like I said, it was just a weird game, because there was just so much, there was minimal offensive threats out there. Like,
yeah, I mean, that was the entire thing about it for UCF.
Yeah, the game was in the 80, which is weird.
Yeah, and the shocking thing to me was, Duke shot 9-for-20 from three, and UCF missed a whole bunch of free throws, and they were still right in a game that was played in the high 70s.
Yeah. I mean, UCF only missed 5 free throws.
But there were a couple one-on-ones that they missed.
Yeah,
maybe, right. I only missed it because they missed 4 straight. It's probably why.
I mean, they went 15-for-20 from the line, which,
yes, that'll get it done.
But Duke went 7-for-12, so it kind of balanced out there. Like, but yeah, like, it was 10-for-25 from three, but UCF went 9-for-18 from three, which, again, like, that's not who either of these teams were.
Yeah. I remember I asked Johnny Dawkins in, like, October. I gave him probably 6 months before I brought it up, but I asked him, like, how he came up with that, the idea to just not guard Trey Jones or put Taco Fall on Jordan Goldwire. And he said that it's something that they've always had in their arsenal since Taco got there. They only used it a couple times, but they knew that they were going to have to use it against Duke because I mean, that's how a lot of teams played him.
Yeah.
And he said he thought it was a good thing that they didn't have to bust it out until the second half. Because if you bust it out in the first half, then Coach K is going to have, a way to adjust to it at halftime. Whereas taking it in the second half, it's a little bit harder to tweak when you don't really expect that. Because, I mean, Duke, you don't see guys like Taco Fall. Like, that's why I think that adjustment is so creative and so smart from Johnny Dawkins, who's like, he's also not a guy when you're sitting here like, oh, what do you think of when you think of Johnny Dawkins? You think like, yeah, he got to the Elite Eight one time with Stanford and, you know, he gets a lot of talent, but he maybe isn't the best coach. So like his reputation is not as like a tactical X's and O guy. And, right. and this was to me just an absolutely brilliant little tweak.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely was like, it's been talked about a lot. That's one thing I actually remember from this game outside of the missed layup at the buzzer or the tip in at the buzzer is everyone talking about whether you called it a triangle two, just the defensive adjustment that UCF made in the second half. Like that's what everyone talked. At least that's what I remember everybody talking about. That's what I remember like on Twitter that day, everyone talking about.
Yep. So there are two other things that everybody talked about from that game. The first one was the shot clock violation and the ball.
I forgot about how long that went on.
Yes. So here's a weird take for you and tell me what you think about this.
Yes, Nigel Hayes had a shot clock violation. I agree.
No. Yeah. so I actually thought that the amount of time that it took to make that decision added to the drama of this game. I'm kind of like anti review and anti replay because I think that refs lean on it a little bit too much. Like there was another point in the game where they went back to the monitor to add like 0.4 seconds, right?
Right.
Like I think that when you have to stop a game for a minute and a half to add 0.4 seconds left when there's 7.7 seconds on the clock, I think that's a little bit too much. When you have stoppages after every whistle in the final 30 seconds to have to go back and review something, that's too much. But I think that when you have like these huge turning point calls, like the coolest thing about this was they had to have been playing these replays in the arena at the same time that we were watching it live on TV, because when we saw, like when they changed the angles, they changed to one from the top where it looked like it didn't hit anything. And you heard the crowd noise react yep. at the same point that Jim Nantz reacted. But then they showed another crowd, angle from the
floor. Crew was reacting too.
Like yeah.
Serator, Raft.
Everybody was.
Yeah. It was crazy.
And then they showed another angle and you had another reaction from yeah. the crowd. And like that only added to the drama. And it kind of, this is a little bit off topic and I'm going to talk about Tottenham again, but in the run to the Champions League semifinals last year against Man City, they were playing in the quarterfinals. And there were two goals that were determined by VAR, which is video assistant referee, which yeah. is basically their instant replay system. And one of them was a Tottenham goal that was really close that bounced off a guy's hip, but looked like it might have nicked his elbow first. And they ended up allowing the goal to stand after like a 4-minute review. The other one was a goal that ended up winning the game for Manchester City in like the 93rd minute that got waved off because the guy was slightly a bit offside. But and like the drama of those reviews added to it because they are necessary reviews, critical plays, critical moments, things that kind of like, I don't want to say it adds to the game itself, but it adds to the drama of the experience of watching it. So that stuff I don't mind. Like the reviews where you have like 10 minutes of review for stuff that just is completely utterly meaningless is really frustrating to me. But yeah. like in that moment, I thought that review added to the drama and added to the experience of watching that game. Does that make sense?
Yeah. My stance on review is I just wish there was a time limit. Like when I eventually live out my dream of becoming commissioner of college basketball, I'm going to have a strict, like you have 60 seconds because it's either indisputable or you see the call. Teams can't huddle up. 60 seconds review. If you don't see anything different that 60 seconds, play on. Like
we probably should have said this before we started going in on these rants. But what happened was for people that don't remember is that BJ Taylor with the shot clock winding down threw up 72-70 with about 2 minutes and 20 seconds left in the game. UCF is up. BJ Taylor throws up a shot that like kind of goes somehow over the back. He's like on the opposite wing, yeah. right? And it goes over the basket and somehow happens to go off the lip of the backboard between the edge of the rim and the backboard. And it's very difficult to see if it touched the rim at all. I personally think
thick part kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that it actually nicked.
I think it does. The very
edge of the rim. But it actually, so it comes off the backboard and it gets loose and it ends up in Taco Fall's hands and he dunks it to put UCF up.
No, not loose. UCF gets a rebound. I forget who from UCF gets the rebound.
Yeah, but like
shoots it and it gets blocked and then Duke kind of stops on that again though too because they think, oh, that's just a shot clock violation.
Yeah, whatever it was, it bounced around for a while, ends up in his hands, dunks. UCF 2 points. Well after the shot clock would have sounded if the ball didn't miss, so they had to go to the basket review that. Sorry, go back to the point you were making.
So that's just where I stand. Like I get that it, like everyone was on pins and needles. Is it because it's 72-70 at the time and everyone's sitting there waiting? Is it a shot clock violation? Is it a 4 point game? Whatever. I just wish it was a minute long, like for every review, because I would rather, I guess, sacrifice, for lack of a better word, that pins and needles feeling in this game for the review when it's adding 0.2 seconds left to a clock and it takes the same amount of time.
So you thought that it hit the rim?
I thought it did. Like, when I say I thought, I'm like 53-47% leaning towards I think it hit the rim. Because, yeah, again, there are so many angles. When the one right over the top looks like it doesn't hit, but every other angle, it looks like there's some sort of other deflection just the way the ball bounces.
Yeah, that's exactly. I think it just kind of grazed it.
Right.
And part of the reason why it was so difficult to see is that it grazes the rim, then immediately hits the backboard. So you can't see the spin change. But either way, like they made the right call because it was not indisputable.
Either I agree. So I have no problem with that call.
If you blow the whistle and you call it a shot clock violation, you can't review it the other way. Like you can't. It was one of those ones that's too close to change. So after that whole drama, I do want to note that Duke was up 66-59, and UCF reeled off like five straight jumpers. Three of them were from Aubrey Dawkins.
Yeah,
and
not good jumpers like, either.
And that's how they like. They all tough shots. Yeah. One of them was like a 27-foot three from the wing with a hand in his face. Like he hit a turnaround over Zion in the middle of the lane. It was a really, really impressive like run of just like making shots from UCF, right. And that's not what they were known for. So 74-70, Duke ball. They go down to the other end of the floor, and this is like one of probably the most memorable moment from the game. And for me, it's kind of the one shitty moment was UCF forces a turnover. It's a 2-on-1 break. And I forget who it was that I think it was, what was his name? Leroy Griffin. What's his name? Something Griffin. Zion Griffin. Whatever his name was. The guy, the Griffin guy. He's coming down and he throws a lob to Aubrey Dawkins on a 2-on-1 break. And it should have been an easy dunk. And it just kind of like Deion Griffin, and it skips off of Aubrey Dawkins' hands, and he misses the dunk. And they come down the other way, and Cam Reddish immediately bangs home a three. So instead of being up 76-70 with like a minute 50 left, UCF is only up 74-73 with like 1:45 left, and it's just that changed everything. So instead of having complete control and as long as you don't commit a turnover, you're going to win this game. It went from that to like, oh shit. Like here comes Duke. We have to score twice to be able to win this thing.
Yeah. Because if they make that dunk, Dawkins make that dunk is up 76-70. I know that UCF's free throw shooting percentage, like for the season was atrocious. They were 330th in the country at 65%. Most of that was due to Taco Fall. They had an 80% or 78% shooter in BJ Taylor and 83.5% shooter in Aubrey Dawkins. The two guys are going to have the ball in their hands down the stretch. So those are the guys going to the free throw line. Guess what? They're probably making
80%. They're making their free throw.
Right.
The way Aubrey Dawkins was shooting, he was making his free throw.
So that's such a thing. And back to the lob, wasn't a bad pass. Like Aubrey Dawkins just missed it.
So the reason – I guess I could just do it now. The reason why that would be my one shitty moment is because of the reaction that lob got. That is the right pass.
Yeah.
When you have the people that say that you can't throw a lob there have never played with anybody that is as athletic as Aubrey Dawkins. Or just that is the right pass.
Or just hasn't played because you want the points. Like the
yes,
yes, a minute 50 does not sound like a lot of time. That's a ton of time still. You need points in a 4-point game with 2 minutes to go.
So I don't know if that was necessarily, it could have been a bad pass. It could have been Aubrey Dawkins dropped the ball. We didn't get a good enough replay to say it either way. So I don't want to put it all on Aubrey Dawkins, and I don't want to put it all on Daylon Griffin. But the bottom line is that was the right decision to make.
100%.
It was the right pass to throw. The execution of the lob did not go well. But it's the same thing as like throwing a bounce pass into it. Sometimes guys miss layups. Sometimes guys miss dunks. Sometimes guys miss free throws. Like, it was the right play to make.
Yeah.
Because when you have it, they ran twice lob plays out of timeouts for Aubrey Dawkins to catch a lob. He's 6'6" with a long wingspan and like a 40-something inch vertical. All he has to do is catch a ball and dunk it. That is way, way easier.
Or just catch the ball and waste more time.
Whatever it is, like that's not a difficult play. Yeah. Like people that were criticizing that decision have never played with anybody athletic enough to catch something like that. You throw that pass because 99 times out of 100, they're going to catch it and dunk it. It's not a complicated play. And to me, the reason that's the one shitty moment is because the fact that it didn't come off, whether it was Griffin's fault, whether it was Aubrey Dawkins' fault, the fact that it didn't come off, that turned into a thing where it was like, well, you can't throw that pass. Yes, you fucking throw that pass every single time. If I'm Johnny Dawkins and I see Daylon Griffin not throw the lob there, I am mad at him.
Yeah, unless he has a valid reason. Like, I saw a guy leaning this way. It's like, okay, play to safe.
Throw that pass.
I 100% agree. I am somebody, just my mentality from a basketball standpoint of, you know, if you want to call it a coaching mentality, a player mentality, whatever side you want to call this from where I'm coming from, I want points because, again, you have to score at some point in that last minute and 50 seconds in order to win the game.
Yep.
So take the 2 points that should be free in the sense of, I mean, that play is completed what? 90% of the time?
99 times out of 100. 99 times out of 100. Aubrey Dawkins catches that lob.
95, let's say, conservatively. That's the highest percentage you're ever going to have.
Yeah. You have to throw that lob. You have to throw the lob. So yeah. I had to get that ran out. All right. And then the way that the game ends is that Duke comes down and bangs a three at the other end of the floor. I think this was the possession where BJ Taylor drew a foul and hit two free throws. Am I right? Like, he picked up Zion's fourth with like 45 something seconds left. And goes to the line, makes two free throws at 76-73. You go back the other end of the floor. Javon Delorier low key grabs a huge offensive rebound over Taco, which I completely forgot that happened. And the ball ends up with about 20 seconds left in Zion's hands. He drives right, spins back to his left, and finishes a ridiculous layup. Like, it wasn't over Taco, it was like through Taco. There are three people on the planet, I think, that can probably finish that shot. Zion Williamson was the only college basketball player, I think, that can make the shot that he made over Taco Fall in that situation.
Yeah. This might be going into one of my one shitty moments. I hated the way BJ Taylor tried to flop on that. Like, I thought he tried. BJ Taylor is the one guarding Zion to set the stage. Zion catches the ball. He's on the wing, left-hand wing. BJ Taylor's on him, defending him one-on-one. And as Zion is driving right around the free throw line, Taylor kind of does like the head snap a little bit because Zion is going into a spin move away from the way Taylor's leaning. So he kind of has an arm go out a little bit. And at that time, instead of just moving his feet and kind of staying with the spin, Taylor kind of flops back a little bit. And I felt like that just created even more space. Again, ridiculous layup by Zion. But that allowed Zion to get to that point for the layup. I felt
you want to hear my take?
Yeah.
BJ Taylor's only option there was to flop because Zion Williamson, when he spin back, that drop step spin move he has going left, if you're on the wrong spot, if he has you on his hip, you're dead. And he was on Zion's hip, and there was absolutely nothing that he was going to be able to do.
I get that, but when you, again, this is a little bit revisionist history, but when you have Taco standing at the rim behind you,
it didn't matter. Like,
I don't think charge is your only move there. I think I'd rather try to hack him and not let him get a shot up. Like, if he's going to shoot, foul the shit out of him. Both of them.
Yeah, no, I hear you, but they're like BJ Taylor's only option to me there is the fall. The only thing he could have done was grab Zion Williamson's right arm, and Zion Williamson would have been able to finish with his left hand. Maybe not over Taco in that spot, but yeah, I hear you. All right,
I understand it. I just hate that play at that stage with Taco behind you.
Yeah. So, well, UCF also drew a charge earlier in the game that on that exact same play. Either way, that wasn't a charge. It was definitely a flop by Aubrey Dawkins. And so Zion goes to the free throw line. He misses the free throw, but RJ Barrett gets an offensive rebound. Might have been a push-off. Do you think it was a push-off?
No. Like, that's one of those where it's like you could call it's like football where you say you could call holding on every play. You could probably call that push-off on any scramble rebound.
Yeah, I thought it was a push-off, but it was the kind of thing where I don't think it would ever get called. Like, I think he very clearly pushed Aubrey Dawkins to create space, but it's also the kind of thing where it's like that's never going to get called in the final 20 seconds of the
college. Yeah, just be tougher. Like, push harder if you're the UCF player.
Yeah,
no, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, you have to, in that scenario, because, again, you're talking about, like I said, it's like holding where you can call it on every play in football. On any scramble, that there's going to be hands. Like, that's where you just have to be more physical.
Yep. And so, of course, at the other end of the floor, UCF calls a timeout. The play that they draw up is Aubrey Dawkins setting a screen for BJ Taylor. I think Johnny Dawkins expected Duke to switch, and I think what he wanted was to get BJ Taylor going one-on-one against RJ Barrett. But Trey Jones is up so tight on BJ Taylor that Aubrey Dawkins doesn't actually get a screen on him. Yeah. And you can actually see RJ Barrett take a step to go guard him and have to go get back because, like, Trey's not switching. And so BJ Taylor drives, takes a little, like, 12-foot kind of floater off the glass that misses. RJ Barrett completely whiffs, doesn't even bother to box out Aubrey Dawkins. So lucky that he's not the GOAT for that. And then Aubrey Dawkins comes down the lane, grabs a rebound with one hand, lays it in, and it just rolls off the rim. UCF loses, and Aubrey Dawkins is going to spend the rest of his life thinking about the missed dunk and that missed put back. All right, so let's get into the segmenty stuff to kind of close this out a little bit. What was your one shining moment?
I mean, it's the Zion in one play. That was Zion in a hole. Like, just the move to get to there, the finish, the strength. Like, that's what made Zion Zion.
That play summed up Zion. Like, actually, if you've never seen Zion play, like, all you need is to see that happen, and that kind of just sums up who he is.
You know, like, if it wasn't for that, what I honestly would have had is my, like, shining moment was in the first half, Zion threw a ridiculous, in transition, one-handed bounce pass to a streaking Jones, and then just looked at his hand like he couldn't believe it, or just, like, taunting everybody that he also has that in his arsenal. Because I think people forget that, like, that's a really fucking good passer.
I have that written down as the things that I love. Is Zion Williamson looking at his hand like, did you just do that?
Yep.
You did that. Good job. Good job, hand. Proud of you. Yeah, for my one shining moment, it was Zion's and one.
Yeah.
And I think that just kind of sums up that Duke season more than anything else. Is Zion Williamson drives, gets an and one, misses the game-tying free throw. RJ Barrett gets the offensive rebound on a free throw, scores the winning bucket, and we're like, yeah, Zion Williamson's and one was definitely the one shining moment of that.
As game. RJ Barrett bailed him out so many times during the season,
That is a perfect summation for the Duke basketball season in 2018-2019. I already told you what my one shitty moment is. What was your one shitty
moment? Yeah, it's the miss lob. Because, again, it's just such a basic play that led to I'll just be blunt. It led to too many takes from people who don't understand basketball and don't never played basketball.
Yeah. So for me, what was your defining moment?
Man, that's tough. What do you have?
The misses in the final seconds.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's it.
The image that everybody's going to have, at least for me, that's seared in my mind that I remember more than anything else from this game was the view from the top.
Yeah.
And from the camera above the backboard where you see Aubrey grab the ball, lay it in, clap the backboard, the ball roll off, and the camera, you can kind of see him punch the air. He's looking at looks the other way, sees the clock run out, and then punches the air and walks away. Like, to me, I honestly didn't remember all that much from the game itself. Like, I did something on Trey Jones last summer and, like, just how he was kind of the X factor to what Duke season was going to be. And I went back and I watched a lot of the second half and how UCF played them for part of that. And so I remember those parts of the game, like specifically how UCF defended them. But the ending, there are a lot of like little things I remember. I did not remember about that. The image of Aubrey Dawkins grabbing that ball with one hand and laying it in, and what should have been like his one shining moment, what should have been like the most memorable moment in the history of UCF basketball, didn't happen.
Wow. It still might be. It still is the most memorable moment in UCF basketball.
Not saying all that much. Well, that kind of sums up UCF basketball.
I know, right? Like that, it is.
All right. Quick hitters, and then we can kind of get out of here. What were the things that you loved for really no reason from this game?
I loved BJ Taylor just being cocky the entire time. Like he wasn't demonstrative about it, but you could just tell like the way he carried himself. Like he looked at Duke like, I'm better than these guys.
I loved,
and that's BJ Taylor. Like he was always like that.
Yeah, I loved Raftery's taco puns, like his taco dad jokes. He had one where he said, I'll see your Zion and raise you a large taco.
He was then talking about taco diets. And he was like, oh, that's all I need.
He said, a steady diet of taco is not good for your health. And the best part about it is like Grant Hill tried a couple of taco puns and they just really did not come off. Like, no.
That, I will like, say, Grant, here's why I did hate about Taco Fall. He's the reason that we didn't get a Bill Raftery man-to-man call for like the only game I can ever remember not getting a Raftery man-to-man call to start the game. Because they dropped the Taco Fall 132 tips in a row, then they started making taco puns right off the bat.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. You're right. So that's the one thing we got to hate about Taco Fall. We found it. Yeah. He's finally a regular human. We can hate him for that. Yeah, well, whatever.
I'm a Knicks fan. I hate the Celtics.
Anything else you loved?
As much as I hate Duke, and I don't hide it, I love that Jordan Goldwire came in and just was such an X factor. Because like I said, to start the show, like those guys were not great players. And I guess I should preface it. They're not typical Duke great players or Duke good players on a great team. They were just kind of like subpar role players. But Goldwire, when they ran that 2-2-1 trap and him hitting the three, I mean, he only had one shot, but he was as important to that run and win as you know anyone not named Zion and RJ.
He was very useful at a specific thing, and he did that job well.
Right.
So this is going to sound like me just being a Duke, like loving Duke, but I loved watching Zion Williamson play college basketball. Like
he was too cool for Duke, man.
There's a level of greatness that we don't often experience at the college level. Because too often, like the guys that end up being great pros are not good enough at 19 to be able to do that, right. Or they're like LeBron James and just go straight to the pros. Zion was that level of great, and watching him do things that it doesn't feel like human beings should be able to do, and seeing like the joy and the passion that he played with. Like, there are people out there that hated Zion because of like the amount of coverage that he got. And I just do not understand that at all. Like there is nothing about the way that guy plays, the way that he competes, the kind of human he is and the way that he acts around them. Like there's nothing about him that I can find like even like unlikable.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like maybe the fact that he kind of like has this weird penguin like kind of walk, like his gait.
I like that.
He kind of like wobbles when he walks.
He has the most distinct walk in the NBA.
Yeah, like it's very weird. Like, so if you want to tell me you don't like that, like, cool. I can kind of get behind that. He has a weird walk. But that's literally the worst thing that I think I can say about Zion Williamson is that he walks funny.
The biggest compliment I saw someone give to him was a guy who I work with who watches college basketball, but, you know, isn't a dire college basketball fan. He said, I hate that Zion makes people like to watch Duke basketball.
Yeah.
And that kind of summed up, like, that was the perfect summary. Like, I said, like, he was too cool for Duke. Like, Duke is not Zion.
You should have taken credit for that.
I know I should. I mean, probably will. But, like, everybody tuned in to watch Duke last season, or two seasons ago now, because of Zion. Because it was like, I want to see what this guy can do. Like, obviously, like I said, he starts off with these dunks, but he's a ridiculous passer. He can handle the ball. his layup package was just as unbelievable as his dunk package. So it's like he made people want to watch Duke. And for a year, like I remember when he left, everyone was like, all right, I can't wait to hate Duke again this season.
Yep. And I also am very proud of the fact that I had him as number two. Like, you know how everyone does their top 100 players lists?
Yeah.
Most people had Zion kind of in like that, like 10 to 12 range. I had him number two behind only RJ Barrett. So I whiffed a little bit there, but I was ahead of the field on him. So I'm going to take the W there. Things that I hated. Number one, Taco Fall did not have the rec specs on.
Yeah, as he didn't.
He wasn't wearing the rec specs.
He didn't.
So the first time that I met him, like he had like the lenses that he had in the rec specs that he was wearing were like, you know how in movies when you have like the old like science nerd that you go meet, yeah, and they're wearing the glasses that are as thick as like a beer bottle.
Yeah, everybody like from the nerds.
Yes, and he had those lenses in the rec specs that he had on. He wasn't wearing rec specs. Like Taco Fall without rec specs is like pizza without cheese.
Right. Yeah, you need taco. Well, you need
breakfast. It just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel right. And the only other thing I hated is that I spent like probably a good week and a half in the 2019 season with the take that Trey Jones was the most irreplaceable player on the Duke basketball team. And literally, you didn't tell me I was an idiot for it.
I don't remember Sam, that.
Nobody that I know told me that I was an idiot for saying that Trey Jones was the most irreplaceable piece on the Duke roster.
Maybe remember I just when he got injured? Joking.
No, like remember when he got injured? Like yeah, it was like shoulder. A wrist injury or something, or yeah, a shoulder in like December, and he was out for a week and a half.
That's what it was. It was a Syracuse.
Yes, that's what it was. And nobody told me I was an idiot for this. Like I need better friends. How is no one going to step up and tell me I'm an idiot for that take?
I need better friends because I shouldn't have to say that to somebody.
Yeah, fair enough. That's fair. That's a fair criticism. I deserve that for that take.
I hated and I loved this at the same time. During the halftime interview, I guess Tracy Wolfson learned this during the halftime interview or right at the start of the second half. She told a story of Krzyzewski talking to his team as UCF was on a little bit of a run to start the second half. And he got on the floor and started slapping the floor and pleaded for Duke to slap the floor at the timeout huddle. And I just hate what I hate everything about that. But I love the fact that Krzyzewski was just like self-aware during that time.
Yeah, that's peak Krzyzewski.
Right, it was, and it was like it just dropped in the middle of this game. And I was like, wait a minute, we need to spend more time on this interview right here. But it was, for the most part, like I was expecting a lot more Johnny Dawkins, Krzyzewski talk. And it was a lot, but it wasn't as much as I honestly thought there was going to be.
It was the right amount, because right, it was the amount you have to talk about it.
I get you.
It has to be something in the broadcast. It has to be a constant theme in the broadcast. It's one of the underlying storylines.
Aubrey's going off too.
As Aubrey's going, like you have to talk about it, but it didn't become the kind of thing that it was like. It didn't become overwhelming.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it was the perfect amount of it. Did you have a favorite random moment?
Yeah, Raftery absolutely being disgusted with Zion's foul call in the second half. They went to a commercial break, and it was when Zion, I think it was BJ Taylor. No, it was, who was the guy? Black or Brown? What was the guy's name?
Oh, Chad Brown.
Chad Brown, yeah. Got a rebound, spun from the baseline towards the lane.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I know the play you're talking about.
And Zion, he ripped it from him, and they called a foul. And Raftery was absolutely disgusted with the call. And went to a commercial break, and like they cut off his ranting as they were going to commercial break. He was just like, "That's not even a foul." And you just hear him like heavy breathing, like this is ridiculous.
My favorite part about that is he's ranting about it not being a foul as they show a clip of Zion just coming from like shoulders all the way down the dude's arms and ripping the ball out. Like it was very clearly a foul. I had no problem with that. I had a bigger problem with Taco Fall committing roughly 13 fouls and only getting called for five of them.
Like, the one before, right after his third foul, they called him for his third foul, which was not a foul at all. And then the next, like two possessions later, Zion spun attack baseline, and like Taco just punched him in the face. Yeah. And they're just like, play on.
Yeah. No, not a foul. I kind of loved it though. Like I would pay money to watch like Zion Williamson and Taco Fall like just go head to head at the rim. Like,
well, do you remember going into that game? Taco Fall had the quote that said, "I'm not going to let Zion dunk on me."
He didn't.
That's what I'm saying. But that was the game-winning thing going into this game.
Yeah. Well, of course it is, because you have a 7'6" dude and the best dunker that we've ever seen in college basketball.
Still rare to hear like that straight of a quote from somebody like Taco, though.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's Jim Nance's tie. That's all we got left. Who you got? I think the answer is easy.
Aubrey.
It's either going to be Aubrey or Zion. The only two options.
I mean, I make a case for RJ.
Because he had the game-winning bucket?
He also had a decent game. Like, it was a very RJ Barrett-type game.
What was his line?
He ended up with
26 and 8 or something like that, right?
RJ had 16-8-4 on only 2 turnovers. He was 2-for-3 from 3.
Where did I get 26 from? That was dumb. No, I think it's got to be. It's either Zion or
yeah, I mean, they both dropped 32, so I get that. But I'm saying I could RJ's like that somewhat third guy.
I'm going to give it to Zion because you can't. I don't think you can give it to Aubrey when we said that the shitty moment was him missing a dunk, yeah, and the defining moment was him missing a very makeable putback.
But without him, we're not even talking about this game.
Yeah, but I don't think you can give it to a guy that missed the dunk and missed the layup that for what would have changed the game. So, as always, rate, review, subscribe to this podcast. Give us 5 stars. If you want to hear us talk about a game, literally any tournament game that you liked, I would prefer if we kind of get some of the random ones, like Riggs mentioned before. Please do that so we can talk about them on the pod. As soon as you are done doing that, rate, review, and subscribe to the Fundamentally Sound podcast anywhere that you can get podcasts for absolutely free. That is the one that Riggs hosts. That is where he saves all of his best takes, his best analysis, and his best dad jokes since he is now a father. So, Riggs, appreciate the time, my man. I'll catch up with you again on Thursday.